Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and right now we begin a series of 10 conversations for the 10th anniversary of 9/11. This is part of WNYC's decade 9/11 coverage. Most of these 10 conversations will be pairings of New Yorkers who I think you'll find it fascinating to hear from together. So coming up in this series, we'll talk with the writers Pete Hamill and Suketu Mehta together, designer Milton Glaser and New Yorker architecture critic Paul Goldberger together, Tariq Ali in London and Chris Dickey in Paris together, Brooke Gladstone and Slate military writer Fred Kaplan, who happened to be married, together, and Jonathan Safran Foer and brother Franklin Foer, New Republic editor, together, and more pairings. We begin the series now with two people who have become very well known as a result of 9/11, Julie Menon and Daisy Kahn. Julie Menon, the chair of Community Board 1 in Lower Manhattan. After the attack, she founded a group called Wall Street Rising, designed to restore vitality and vibrancy to the neighborhood. She has served on the jury for the World Trade Center Site Memorial Competition, serves on boards including the Lower Manhattan Development Corporation and the Downtown Alliance. She helped lead the charge to not have Khalid Sheikh Mohammed tried in Lower Manhattan, but she was a key supporter of the proposed Islamic Cultural Center. And I imagine she'll have something to say about evacuating Battery Park City for Hurricane or Tropical Storm Irene. Daisy Kahn was to be the co-founder, with her husband Imam Faisal Abdul Rauf, of the Islamic Cultural Center, which became such a political flashpoint. They have run a neighborhood mosque blocks from the Trade Center since the 1980s. Kahn is also executive director of the group ASMA, the American Society for Muslim Advancement. So, Julie and Daisy, so nice to have both of you back on WNYC. Thank you for doing this together.
Thank you, Brian. It's a pleasure to be with you.
And thank you. I'm actually calling from overseas, but I'm delighted to be with you.
Where are you today?
I'm in Scotland.
Mm-hmm. Can we begin on September 10th? Can the two of you talk to each other? And I'm going to try to back out of these conversations as much as I can through this series. About what the neighborhood was to you before it became known as Ground Zero. It was such a funny hybrid in a way, even then, part Wall Street culture, part City Hall culture, part trendy gentrified residential neighborhood. Can you talk to each other about what this neighborhood was to you before the attacks? Julie, you want to start?
Absolutely, Brian. Well, I lived down in Lower Manhattan, a couple blocks from Ground Zero prior to 9/11, and I owned a business down there. I owned a restaurant and catering business. I had 75 employees, and certainly being a part of that neighborhood was a wonderful experience. It really was on the cusp of becoming a 24/7 neighborhood. And we were starting to get a tremendous number of new residents move into the neighborhood, starting to get new parks, new schools. And so we really were feeling that 24/7 community. And I do want to point out that it's quite ironic in many respects, because when you talk about the founding of Lower Manhattan, originally it was a mixed-use neighborhood. The first people who ever came to Lower Manhattan, many of them lived and worked. They were shop owners, and many of them lived above the shop. And so you really had that live-work community originally in Lower Manhattan. And then when 9/11 hit, obviously it was a tremendous blow to our neighborhood. We have a 16-acre hole in the heart of our neighborhood. And in those days and weeks after the tragic events of 9/11, there were many people who said the neighborhood would never recover. There were people who said, oh, well, people will never live downtown again, and they certainly aren't going to want to work downtown, and they absolutely won't want to visit downtown. And as we approach a 10-year anniversary, we are very proud in Lower Manhattan that we proved those naysayers wrong. We're the fastest growing residential neighborhood. We have 30,000 new residents. I know Daisy knows that fact very well. 30,000 new residents who've moved into our neighborhood. We're the fourth largest commercial business district in the country. And when we open the 9/11 memorial, we're going to have 5 to 7 million visitors come to that memorial. And so I think it's a testament to the strength of the rebuilding process and really the way that we were able to be tenacious and roll up our sleeves and do the hard work it took to get our neighborhood rebuilt.
So, Daisy, as you sit there in Scotland, can you recall what the neighborhood was to you before it became known as Ground Zero?
Well, from 1987 to 1990, I actually worked in the towers. I worked on the 106th floor at the topmost office floor, which was in the Guinness's Book of World Records. And I worked in the neighborhood for about 3 years. And I remember the whole building intimately, and the Winter Garden, which had just been built around that time. I made a lot of friends. It was my neighborhood when I was single, so I had lots of fond memories of going out to all the wonderful restaurants in the neighborhood. And then I also, ironically, found my faith in Tribeca. When I entered a beautiful little mosque in Tribeca when I was working on Greenwich Street then, and then consequently, you know, met my husband there, and we got married, and my whole new life began there.
Found your faith? You're a convert?
No, I mean, I was born a Muslim, but, you know, I had strayed a little bit for a little while, and then I was searching and actually found God back, you know, in Tribeca. So I have very not only very strong spiritual feelings towards that neighborhood, but also personal feelings because I had spent a lot of my singlehood there. And then my husband, you know, who was preaching already in the mosque, I helped him with all his work, and you know, in partnership, we began the American Society for Muslim Advancement, and this next chapter of my life began. But on September 10th, when my husband was conducting his daughter's marriage in Colorado on this beautiful mountaintop called Golden, Colorado, and September 11th, we were ready to take a plane back to New York, and I was transfixed when I saw what I saw, because it was our neighborhood that was going down. It was all the people that we were so concerned about that we knew in the neighborhood. And we couldn't rush back. All the flights had been canceled, and it took us 5 days to get back to New York. We had to drive back, and we were devastated because it was not only our neighborhood and our mosque was shut down, but all the memories, all the people that we knew, but also it was our country, our city that had been attacked. And then, of course, very shortly, we began to fear that it might be Muslims. So imagine the kind of emotions that we had, emotions that our neighborhood was attacked, emotions that it might be Muslims who did it, then we have to, you know, defend the actions of people that mm-hmm. we have nothing to do with. So the neighborhood meant a lot more to us than just a neighborhood in New York City.
Why, looking back, and I guess this was before you even met him, did your husband, Imam Fazl Abdul Rauf, set up a mosque in Tribeca in the 1980s, in the first place, as opposed to any other location in the New York area? People might think of parts of Brooklyn and Queens as being more concentrated with Muslim immigrant populations, not think of Tribeca in that way. So what was the initial attraction for him and the community, and even how did you and he see the congregation change between the 1980s and, say, 2001?
The mosque was actually established by a Sufi master who was a spiritual master who came from Turkey to establish a spiritual community. And he attracted Lex Hickson, who was then a very prominent ecumenical spiritual leader who used to have a radio show and attracted a lot of local converts, including the Sheikha Fariha, who now is the spiritual leader of that mosque. And she, along with Lex Hickson and along with the Sheikh from Turkey, established this mosque on Mercer Street, which was actually a very beautiful, pristine, large building. And it was a beautiful spiritual community that attracted people from all kinds of places. It was a haven for spirituality. And then my husband was invited by Sheikh Muzaffar to be the imam of the mosque because he wanted somebody with the right kind of grounding, orthodoxy, and he wanted people to practice Islam, not just, Sufism, which was more a spiritual a practice with that community. And that's when my husband stayed there and mm-hmm. catered to the community. But as you said, Brian, it went from being a very small spiritual community on Fridays to being a very large congregation, so much so that at one time, several years before we had proposed the community center, there were lines going out As Julie said, there are so many more people. There are lines going out the door. We have to have 3 to 4 services on any given Friday because of the influx of immigrants coming into Lower Manhattan, especially Canal Street, and Muslims coming of age and basically working in the financial district. So, and we pray on Fridays. So most of the residents, you know, in addition to the residents, you have this influx of people who are workers who are working there on Fridays. Yeah. So
this is WNYC, FM and AM New York, WNYC.org, the first in our series of 10 conversations for the 10th anniversary of 9/11. Our first conversants are Julie Menon, the chair of Community Board 1, in Lower Manhattan, and Daisy Khan, who is just speaking, who was to be the co-founder with her husband, Imam Faisal Abdul Rauf, of the Islamic Cultural Center, which became such a political flashpoint. We can also take some of your phone calls for this conversation, and I'll just say that this is not going to be a debate about the Islamic Cultural Center. This is a much broader conversation with two people who are longtime residents of Lower Manhattan, to talk about the neighborhood before and after 9/11. So, listeners, how did the neighborhood change for you? It became a symbol, but of what? People disagree what it's supposed to represent and for whom. So, for you, what does the Lower Manhattan neighborhood, as close to the World Trade Center site as you want to define it as, Tribeca, or call it what you will, what does it symbolize for you today? If you're somebody who actually lives there and tries to live a regular life there or works there and tries to be a regular commuter there, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. If you came to live there after 9/11, why? Was it because of 9/11 in any way? Was it in spite of 9/11 in any way? Talk about that choice for you. Maybe you lived there before 9/11 and chose to move away. You could call, too, because we're talking about the neighborhood before and after with Julie and Daisy and with you. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. When did you two meet each other? Julie, when did you meet Daisy?
Daisy and I met in the spring of the prior year when the project was first proposed, and we met actually at a community board meeting. And in looking back at that
time, what year was that?
It was the year that it was proposed, so not this past spring, but the spring before. And we met when Daisy and Imam Faisal first proposed the project to the community board. We had several phone conversations, actually, before we met. And then we met at a community board meeting. I wish, quite honestly, that I had met Daisy in better circumstances, in that we unfortunately saw some of the worst divisiveness and intolerance emerge, which I think was most unfortunate, a lot of which was driven, by the way, by people not residing in Lower Manhattan, but by people residing outside of Lower Manhattan who wanted to weigh in on their views on the project. And so at the time, I presided over what can best be described as a highly contentious community board meeting, which both Daisy was there and Sharif Al-Gamal was there and Imam Faisal was there. And we heard from people who, some of whom were absolutely in favor of the project, but some who were rabidly against the project. Our community board approved the project in a vote 29-1. And it's something that I thought was extremely important, in large part because our country was founded on religious freedom. And I also felt that many people were not really aware of the facts behind this. The facts that, as Daisy pointed out earlier in the conversation, that that her husband had been operating a mosque in the neighborhood, perhaps it was about 10 blocks, I believe, from Ground Zero. And so they wanted to move from a site that was 10 blocks to a site that was 3 blocks. So this idea that, well, 10 blocks is okay, but 3 blocks isn't, to me, that does not make a tremendous amount of sense, and I also believe government should never be stepping in on the right of any religious group to worship as they see fit. And I say this as someone from the Jewish faith. My mother is a former Holocaust survivor, so I thought it was something that was extremely important to stand up for.
Was there a getting-to-know-you dance between you, cautious, political, diplomatic, whatever, over this idea of the Islamic Cultural Center and the possible ramifications outside? Julie?
Well, Well, when I first spoke to Daisy on the phone, one of the things that I suggested is perhaps we should be reaching out to the 9/11 family members, and let's reach out to them very early. Because I sit on the jury that picked the memorial, and I sit on the Memorial Foundation Board, and I have spent many years working very collaboratively with the 9/11 family members, and there are a lot of different family groups, and I thought it was absolutely critical that we reach out in advance to some of those groups. The timeline in terms of how the project came to the community board, it came to us in May of the prior year, and then we had our full board vote later in the month in May. So it doesn't necessarily give a lot of time for outreach. Mm-hmm. But I know that Daisy felt very strongly she wanted to take it immediately to the community board full vote.
Daisy, what was it like meeting Julie for the first time?
You know, when I walked into that room, there was such a chaos in the room, and it was the most unbelievable experience of my life, because I'd never experienced that face of America, especially in Lower Manhattan, you know, where it's such a tolerant place. But I remember Julie sitting there with her gavel in her hand, and she just kept silent, telling everybody to be quiet, and she was really trying to control the crowds, because the crowds were not controllable. But I respected her for that, because many times when we were speaking, we were getting shouted at, and they wouldn't allow us to finish our sentences, and she really wanted to keep this meeting extremely civil and wanted to give us an opportunity to speak. And ultimately, the board decided to vote in our favor, and I have a lot of respect for this board and the way they voted.
Let's take our first caller, Wendy in Jersey City. You're on WNYC. Hi, Wendy.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. You asked how things in the neighborhood had changed. I lived in Tribeca briefly in the late 80s and then worked at 7 World Trade for 10 years. And after that, commuted into Jersey City from Brooklyn. And what I wanted to comment on was the subway station for the A train at Chambers Street.
Uh-huh.
There's art in there. The tile mosaics were made into a whole grouping of, or a scattering of, single human eyes looking out, sort of maybe in alarm, but looking out at you. And this clearly wouldn't have been intended as the purpose of the artwork, but my first return through that station, maybe a year or two after the attacks, was as if the souls had been trapped in those walls of the victims, and they were sort of staring at you. It was like walking through a catacomb. I'm sorry, I don't have a more uplifting or affirming reaction to your show, but this was one of the things that really changed as far as meaning in that neighborhood for me.
Wendy, and thank you for that.
To get used to it.
Yes, and thank you for the courage to call up and talk about something difficult like that. Obviously, so many of us who were here before 9/11 and after 9/11 have different reactions to all kinds of things than we did before. And, you know, some of them are going to be a little bit more on the dark side like that. Julie Menon, are you familiar with the A-Train Chambers stop that she's talking about?
Oh, absolutely. And I'm very familiar with it. And I certainly appreciate the comment, because we do, as you point out, Brian, get many diverse comments from people who live in the neighborhood, who work in the neighborhood, who are visiting the neighborhood, about those kinds of aspects. And certainly the events of 9/11 were a game changer. It's the way that we view our community, and no one can view our neighborhood in the same way since after 9/11. And so I very much appreciate those kinds of comments.
We'll continue in a minute with Daisy Kahn, Julie Menon, and your calls, 212-433-WNYC on Lower Manhattan before and after 9/11. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with the last reminder that I'm going to give you, that we're doing tomorrow's show live from Montclair State University, and you are invited. Our usual 10 a.m. start time will be in the Kasser Theater at Montclair State. Our guests include former governor and 9/11 Commission Chair Tom Kane. That will really be the second of the segments in the series that we are launching today with our current guests, 10 Conversations for the 10th Anniversary of 9/11. But it's not only going to be 9/11 talk. We'll talk with Tom Kane about other things as well. We have other special guests from around New Jersey, WNYC's own Bob Henley, Debbie Gallant, who writes BaristaNet. Do you read that that blog, that website, BaristaNet? It's really great. And a lot of other folks will be asking you to bring the best things and the worst things about your New Jersey town and lots of other stuff. It should be a great event. It is free, and you are invited, but we ask that you reserve a spot on our website. So if you want to join us tomorrow morning at 10 at the Castro Theater at Montclair State, just go to WNYC.org and click on Events for more details and reservations. Hope to see you at Montclair State tomorrow. Now we continue with the first of 10 conversations for the 10th anniversary of 9/11. This is part of WNYC's decade 9/11 coverage, and we're going to have many interesting pairings of people over the next 2 weeks. Today we are kicking it off with Daisy Khan, who was to be the co-founder with her husband Imam Faisal Abdul Rauf of the Islamic Cultural Center, which became such a political flashpoint down in that neighborhood. She is executive director of the group ASMA, the American Society for Muslim Advancement. And Julie Menon, who, among other things, is the chair of Community Board 1 in Lower Manhattan, has been very active since the attacks in helping to bring the neighborhood back in various ways and taking political positions on things when she felt it was appropriate, including against the trial of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed in Lower Manhattan, but for the Islamic Cultural Center. By the way, Julie, just to digress for a moment, what was your position on the evacuation of Battery Park City this weekend?
Well, I think that the mayor took the necessary precautions. I mean, it's always easy to have Monday morning quarterbacking and say, well, why did we have the evacuation and the storm wasn't as bad? But the fact of the matter is Battery Park City is at sea level. It's built on landfill. Landfill is much more porous than bedrock, so if there is flooding, it tends to stay in the neighborhood a long time. And I think he did the prudent thing. My only real criticism is I think there needs to be a much better communication system that the city employs. We at Community Board 1 were critical in getting the city to adopt NYC Notify, which is a online email-based notification system. But in this case, and I'll be giving my comments directly to the city on this, I think, quite honestly, they need to improve upon that because there was not great information flow. If you weren't watching a news conference that the mayor did, or even if you went on to www.nyc.gov, it was difficult to find out, for example, when were train services going to be resuming? When can people get back into their apartment? So that, I think, is something that we need to really look at and see how we can improve upon that kind of system.
Let's take another phone call. Peter in Queens. Peter, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hello. I am calling because I would like to add to a historical perspective to your conversation, and I'm looking forward to the next ones about downtown. St. Peter's Church, which, by the way, was the first Catholic church in New York, is located very near the center. And it's interesting to note that it was proposed to be put on Broad Street, I believe, but there was such an outcry against the Papists that the church could not get a spot on further downtown. At the time, it was at the edge of the north of Manhattan that they were allowed to establish a church, which still exists there. Because of the prejudice against Catholics at the time, there is an incredible historical parallel right now with the proposed Islamic Center. And I wanted to point that out, that history really repeats itself in this instance.
Thank you very much. Daisy Kahn, were you aware of that particular piece of history, and have you seen it as a parallel?
Yes, he's the caller is absolutely right. In fact, Father Madigan had was at the community board meeting testifying on our behalf, and he reminded the audience there, he said that, you know, that there were people who wanted to burn the church, and this is why there is a fence around it. And that, you know, he reminded people that this is a, once again, a parallel, drew this parallel against that. And also, Rabbi Joy Levitt, who was on the show with me, with Christiana Manpur, also reminded the audience that Peter Stuyvesant wouldn't allow a synagogue to be built in Lower Manhattan. So these incidences have happened in history, and that is why we take heart from this and say that, you know, this is just a temporary moment when Muslims are being tested and tried, and we too will prevail.
Julie Menon, do you also see your neighborhood in the big sweep of New York City history? It was, of course, the first neighborhood of New York City, New Amsterdam, when the Dutch settled, and, of course, before that, you know, Native Americans live here, but not even counting that for the sake of this, in terms of the Western European settlers, you know, it was the first neighborhood of New York City, New Amsterdam, then New York. Do you see your what you're living through in Lower Manhattan as part of a hundreds of years sweep of history?
Absolutely, Brian, and that's why I think a lot of people choose to live in Lower Manhattan, because of that very history that you are talking about. Millions of immigrants have come to their shores, and their first place they come is Lower Manhattan. And that is why it is so important that we maintain a diverse community within our neighborhood and a tolerant community. We are a melting pot, and it's very important that Lower Manhattan keep that history. I do want to also take a moment, Brian, to just talk about the 10-year anniversary of 9/11, because many people throughout the city said to me that they feel it is so important that we commemorate the 10-year anniversary, and we do so in a way that properly honors the memory of the lives that were lost, but also looks towards the future. So I just wanted to make sure that your audience knows that we are doing an event, we, the community board, on Saturday, September 10th, where thousands of people will link hands at 8:46 a.m., which is when the first plane hit the first tower. We invite all people to come. People will join hands starting in Battery Park City all along the West Side waterfront, and we expect thousands and thousands of people to come to this event. If people are interested in coming, they need to register on the website, which is www.handinhand911.org. That's handinhand911.org.
So the point is, this hand-in-hand chain is going to start all the way downtown, and if you get enough people to register, it's going to go all the way up to Inwood?
We wanted to go as far north as we can go, and it really depends on how many people register. We've had an enormous response since we announced this about a week and a half ago. And so everyone who comes, we will send, once you go to the registration site, you get an email from us the day before the event telling you which check-in station you're going to be in. We have check-in tents every five blocks all along the West Side waterfront, and we also got the Port Authority to build for us what we're calling the Wall of Remembrance, which is this massive wall that will be up on Saturday, September 10th, and people can post a photo or a note on it. We'll have paper there. People can write notes there. And the 9/11 Memorial Museum has agreed to permanently house it, which I think is so important, because that will then show generations to come how we as a city commemorated the 10-year anniversary. And then lastly, we have community service projects happening in the neighborhood all that afternoon. So I really encourage all of your listeners to go onto our website, handinhand911.org, and register. I'm bringing my three kids. I think it's a very important event for children as well to see this chain and to show how we as New Yorkers are united. We need to get back to that commonality of spirit that united us in the days and weeks after 9/11, when people would literally lend a hand to a stranger. And I think right now we're unfortunately in a very divisive time for our country, and it's so important that we hearken back to that common spirit.
And Daisy Kahn, you have a 9/11 related event too, right?
Yes, in fact, we're commemorating the 10th anniversary uptown in at the Interchurch Center, and we're bringing together the two sets of 9/11 families. I mean, two sets meaning that those people, the Muslim families who have not really been publicly acknowledged, we're going to bring them together along with the 9/11 families that, after Julie suggested, you know, we started dialoguing with them one-on-one, and we'll be honoring their loved ones, and we're commissioning some special works of Islamic calligraphy, which we're going to present to them. But also we're going to be telling the stories of unbelievable stories of courage and resilience of two survivors who have gone on from, you know, nearly dying to surviving to creating wonderful, wonderful initiatives in their own lives. And also we'll be telling the untold stories of how the faith communities have been working tirelessly since 9/11. And we hope to take that video of all the works that have been going on and present that to the museum. Hopefully they will include that in the museum. I think this is the collaboration, the commitment to peace and, you know, harmony in the city has been led by the interfaith communities, but it gets, you know, underreported. So we want to take this opportunity to highlight that. And if anybody would like to come to this event, it is by invitation, but we've now opened it up to the public. They can go to www.asmasociety.org. and just click in and RSVP for the event. We still have some spaces available. But I just wanted to mention one more thing, Brian, and that is on history itself. At one point, Lower Manhattan was also called Little Syria. And many firefighters who used to go to Moran's, which was a very famous pub, was built by an Arab Christian leader many, many years ago. And that Moran's is still there. So Arabs also have you know, a claim to the history in Lower Manhattan. And that is why we were so surprised, you know, when we were attacked, that people didn't even realize that it at one time had been called Little Syria.
This is the first in our series of 10 conversations for the 10th anniversary of 9/11, part of WNYC's Decade 9/11 coverage. Today with two women with long ties to Lower Manhattan, Julie Menon and Daisy Kahn, and a third, Sally in Soho. You're on WNYC. Hello, Sally.
Hi. Yes, I've been here 40 years, and I remember, like Daisy and Julie, the days when it was a very mixed, rich community of all kinds of people. And now what 9/11 has brought on is commercial. The commercial interests that are coming into this neighborhood, especially the real estate people who want to grab the neighborhood from those of us who've been here a long time, it's very alarming. And I am part of a group who is working very hard to prevent a business improvement district from stealing Lower Broadway from us.
What do you think a business improvement district would do?
It would make more tourists and more people on the streets, where there are too many now already. It would commercialize everything so much, but worst of all, it would make things the same.
Just homogenize everything?
Exactly.
Sally, thank you very much. Julie Menon, how much do you agree with her? And could you have predicted that after 9/11, with, you know, the dust and the toxicity that was in the air, and of course with the meaning of the attacks, that it would become as incredibly desirable a residential community as it has?
Well, first of all, let me address Sally's point. So if Soho is, of course, I just want to point out, in Community Board 2. It's actually not in Community Board 1, but I'm very aware of the concerns that Sally mentions, and it's of great concern to the residents of Soho because they do not want to see their neighborhood overrun by the kind of homogeneous character that Sally is speaking about. In Community Board 1 area, in terms of the residential growth, I think the residential growth could have absolutely been predicted, because we have to remember that the government was giving grants to people to stay downtown after 9/11. The single biggest factor of why we have the kind of residential growth in the Community Board 1 area, which is south of Canal, is because right after 9/11, the Lower Manhattan Development Corporation gave grants to people to remain in Lower Manhattan and to move to Lower Manhattan. So many, many people, thousands in fact, decided to move into the neighborhood precisely because of those residential grants. And once they came into the area, they decided to stay. The largest demographic group that is moving into the community board one area are young families. And they're moving in because of the fantastic public schools in the neighborhood. We have been able to build two new public schools, PS 276 in Battery Park, and a new one, which we're actually opening next week, Brian, which is the Spruce Street School in the 76-story Beekman Tower. And we just secured a deal with the Department of Ed to build the third new public school, which will be on Peck Slip all the way over on the east side of our district.
And for you as a mother of, I think, three young children, is that right?
Yes.
Is there any downside to living in the shadow of the towers and the constant reminder of grief that it implies?
No, I don't think that, that is a negative. I think, on the contrary, it's so important that our children know the history of 9/11. My children are very, very aware of it. It makes them who they are because they grew up around this. And when the memorial opens, I, of course, will be bringing my three boys to the memorial to help them learn more about 9/11 and the story behind it. And what do they take from it? The fact that we were attacked precisely because of our values, because we were a free society. It's very important that the next generation understand the context of 9/11 and where we go from here.
I have one more question before you both go. I wonder if you can each compare notes at all about being women in the eye of political storms that intersect with personal grief and with family. And not to overgeneralize, but do you think you bring something different to the public sphere than men who may have different ways of dealing with conflict or the idea of honor, Daisy?
I think that, you know, women are great consensus builders, and this is what we do so well. We strive to bring warring factions and, you know, people who have differences to the table. This is what I find different in all women leaders versus men leaders. And that's why we need the perspective of both. We need both men and women at the table in order to create a balanced society.
Julie, the last word.
Well, the last word, I would just say that the United States ranks 87th in the world in terms of women in elected office. That is behind Afghanistan. It is behind Iraq. It is behind Chile. We must do all that we can to try to get more women to consider public service as a career. And the reason why is because studies show that women in general, women elected officials, score higher marks in terms of consensus building, inclusiveness, and power sharing. And it's very important that that perspective is represented in office.
Daisy Khan, Executive Director of the American Society for Muslim Advancement, was to be the co-founder with her husband Imam Faisal Abdul Rauf of the Islamic Cultural Center in Lower Manhattan. Julie Menon, the Chair of Community Board 1 in Lower Manhattan. Thank you both so much for a wonderful conversation to kick off our series 10 Conversations for the 10th Anniversary. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Brian.
Thank you, Brian. Thank you, Julie.
Part of WNYC's Decade 9/11 coverage. In coming days, you'll hear Pete Hamill and Suketu Mehta, the writers, together. Designer Milton Glaser and New Yorker architecture critic Paul Goldberger together. Tariq Ali in London and Chris Dickey in Paris together. Brooke Gladstone and Slate military affairs writer Fred Kaplan, who happened to be married, together, and Jonathan Safran Foer and brother Franklin Foer together, among other pairings. Tomorrow, live from Montclair State, former governor and 9/11 commission chair Tom Kane. Join us at Montclair State. Tickets are free at WNYC.org. Click on events. And coming up next, on this morning after Hurricane Irene, and for that matter with the 10th anniversary of 9/11 looming, your calls on the unique urban bonding experience of being a New Yorker in an emergency. Are you a real New Yorker until you've gone through one? Give us a call, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692.